Continuing with Paul Wilde on 3rd March, 78. So how did this interpretation of shockwaves come about?
Well, Max Crook was a plasma physicist. Which institute? This was at Harvard. And I was at Harvard at this time with Alan Maxwell most of the time, but Max Crook had a room along the corridor. And he was very interested in these phenomena. He didn't believe our story about type 3 bursts being very fast particles. He was convinced that they were some kind of shockwave or shock phenomena or a wave phenomena in the solar crane. Now, we talked a great deal about the slow and the fast types, and we must have given a joint paper together, but I can't remember the details, tell you.
Well, what I have from the abstract is that type 2 were shock waves in the electron ion gas, and type 3 were shocks in the electron gas.
Yes, well, that's the latter, at least, is pure Crook. And I'm not sure that I really
and the first is Wilde.
I'm not sure that I understood all the all his theory, but he was a very nice chap and we used to get on together very well.
Anyway, that this explanation for the type 2 burst is still in currency.
Yes, I think I came out with it
actually,
most strongly, I think, in a definitive way, and I think it must have been 57, identifying the type 2 as a shockwave.
And was that a joint paper?
That was at yet another IAEA meeting.
Do you mean the Paris Symposium, or...? That was 58. The Dublin meeting, perhaps? You were.
What is the Dublin? It must have been a Dublin meeting.
The reference I have is a joint discussion on solar flares, right, where you talk about type 3 and then type 2, and then you get prolonged storminess.
It was that Dublin meeting. We can check that later on.
So you were convinced, even before going to the US, that there were shockwaves involved?
Yes, it was some. It was stimulated by the observation of the harmonics. Basically a non-linear phenomenon, and shockwaves are basically non. There was an element of speculation in it. Establishment by suggestion rather than very firm criteria.
Well, since you brought up the Dublin meeting, and I think you also went to the Jodrell Bank symposium,
right?
In connection with that meeting,
yes.
Can you tell me of any recollections you have of your work? And how it was received, and what you learned about what else was going on?
I think the highlight for me was the paper that you're reading now, was giving a presentation to a, what do they call it, a joint
discussion.
Mm-hmm. Where, I suppose for the first time, I'd given a sort of major contribution to it before an international audience, and I suppose I was very nervous, but it went down. Very nervous before I started, but I got confidence, and it was very well received, and there was an enormous barrage of questions at the end. And,
oh yes, in fact, they're recorded here, yeah.
But it,
Jennison asks, have other harmonics been observed? And you say, regret? No.
Well, I think you have to make allowance for the reporter.
Right.
And I think Richard Twist, I know Richard Twist came in with some question the first time I met him. But that, I think, was the highlight for me. The Jodrell Bank Symposium was very interesting too.
What do you remember from that?
I think the thing that I remember mostly was Martin Ryle presenting his source count data.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry Pawsey doing a magnificent rebuttal in a way, very modestly, on the basis of Mill's preliminary results. And Pawsey's performance reminded me of Mark Antony's speech. Brutus is an honourable man, and in reference to Martin Ryle.
Right.
But he absolutely won the day. And I've never seen a better performance from Pawsey. He was However, that was the episode.
That's interesting. Going back to the Dublin joint discussion, you established a rather nice correlation, which is shown in figure 5 in this paper, where the type 3 burst velocities correspond nicely to the implied cosmic ray velocities, and the type 2 correspond to magnetic storms.
Right.
And this is the first time anything had been done like this, I guess.
Right. Now, the cosmic rays, I can't remember. That's right. Well, that turned out, I think, to be wrong in the sense that what were these cosmic rays? Cosmic rays that, from the sun, which arrive the order of half an hour or 20 minutes,
right,
or something like
that.
Right,
1 hour.
Yeah. Right. I think now those long time delays are not due to the relatively slow velocities, like 1/3 the velocity of light, but much more to passing differences. And no one now, I think, would believe that.
You mean going as not directly?
Yeah, it's all going in spirals and this type of thing.
I see.
And addition.
But I guess
that made a very nice story at the time, but the correlation between time sequence and cosmic rays didn't hold up.
But the other one is a valid inference between the type 2 bursts and the magnetic storms.
Yes, that stands very firm.
Well, now another point is that you say that there was a great deal of interest in this paper. This was 1955, and yet your results had been around for 4 or 5 years, basically. Was this simply because they weren't generally known?
No, there are lots of rather new things. Really, this is based on the harmonic, which is fairly... What was that?
That was 53, so that was 2 years old.
53. Well, then the fact that the correlation between type 3s and bursts and flares, which was... Have you got that there? That's another letter to Nature. That was Ryle, Murray... Ryle, Robertson and Murray.
54 in Nature.
54,
yeah, that the
right.
Type 3 spectra imply velocities of about 100,000 kilometers a second.
Right. So combine those things, I suppose it was... Okay, it was reviewing stuff which had been published a year or so before, but it's just a question of having an open discussion.
Yeah. But don't you, it seems to me that it might well be that many of the solar physicists and people in related fields just didn't know about this, even though it had been around for a couple of years.
That's quite right, too. I think at that time, I don't suppose the optical people took so very much notice of the radio. This applied in all fields.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think they were reading the Australian Journal of Scientific Research as much as they were reading APJ.
No, that's right. But that's quite right. So it was quite a good thing in the way that radio astronomy had a low profile in astronomy to begin with.
Why was that?
Well, I suppose it allowed the truth to firm up before it was under too much scrutiny.
If you mean the radio astronomers had time to learn about precession and things like this, I heard some interesting stories about about that in the late 40s. Okay, let's move on. You have a paper with Wild Marion Rowe in the Australian Journal of Physics. That was really a follow-up of this.
That was
nature.
A more detailed one of the Nature.
Talking about longitudinal plasma oscillations excited by fast particle streams. Where was the plasma physics coming from? Was that, once again, just a matter of going getting the right book? And
no, I think in this lab, Westfold and Smerd were our theoretical people who used to keep us on the ball with plasma physics.
Mm-hmm.
We picked up what plasma physics we could with their assistance.
I also noticed that in that summer of 55 you went to a discussion on solar flares at University College in London, and there was another London meeting on solar eclipses and the ionosphere.
Yes, I think that was just doing the rounds.
These were not particularly oriented towards radio astronomy.
Not particularly, but they were... this is probably the... This is this paper that came out of that.
Right, on the ionosphere.
But there was obviously an interest in... This is a bit of a rehash of the...
Right, the same figure as the Dublin paper. Yeah.
And this is not unknown in one's...
Oh, sure. So there was nothing substantially different at those meetings?
No, that was purely a rehash.
What else do we have? Let's see, you alluded earlier to getting tired of not finding any flares out at DAPTO and then beginning to look at Cygnus A fluctuations. So can you tell me about what you found from those observations?
We thought that the activity was so low, it might be interesting to look for other applications of that equipment. And did a few calculations, simple calculations, to see what sort of an aerial one would need. And indeed, one could do a very good job with a horizontal rhombic, a very large one, which all that needed was four tall posts and some wire, which we rigged up fairly quickly, quite fixed. It was pointing north. Cygnus just comes over the northern horizon.
Mm-hmm.
And switched it on the first evening, and it was tremendously interesting spectacle of what looked like a whole series of Type 3 bursts going. And I can remember ringing up Joe Pawsey telling him this, they're all going from high to low frequencies, isn't it? And he was very, very intrigued, and he said, perhaps the original explanation of those scintillations are right after all, the fluctuations are right, but they are in fact bursts, as it were.
In the source.
Mm.
Did you really entertain that idea for a while?
We didn't know what was going on that first night. You couldn't sort of tell until you calibrated everything and saw whether it went below the line as well, as it were. And the dips were below the line and with the average evened out. Well, after that very high beginning, we then got involved in a sort of a taxonomic study almost of the different kinds of fluctuations, which produced some very nice optical effects and interference effects. That kept us amused for, I've forgotten how long it was, perhaps the order of a year almost. And we got involved in all sorts of correlations. Somehow, scintillations wore a bit thin after a while, after writing one major and one minor paper, Jim Roberts and I. And we were rather glad eventually to get back to the sun, which seemed to be a more scientifically interesting subject.
Well, I was going to ask you something related to that, namely, here you've spent almost a decade working on the sun, and yet you're quite willing just to go off and work on the ionosphere for a year because the equipment is there, essentially.
Right, yes. Well, it was just because, I say, it was boredom with the sun. I think it's a good thing not to get too stuck in one thing for too long. That's why the next phase after that, of course, is we went in for the interferometry.
But still the sun.
It was the sun,
right,
yes.
But it was
a
rather different instrument, though. Yeah.
Right.
Let's see if we find anything else before then. Well, there is this sideline here where you and John Bolton proposed 21 centimeter Zeeman splitting at 57.
Right.
How did that come about?
Well, I was during my 56th visit to the States, it became 55, 56, it became with Dublin, and I was sort of on my way home, and my last port of call was at Pasadena, where John Bolton was. And I had a visit for just a few days there, and really I can remember, it was the morning after a very memorable party that was held. There were all sorts of very distinguished people there, with everyone letting their hair down. We went to Mount Lawson, and Babcock was on deck measuring the magnetograms. And it emerged out of that, seeing that, and I suggested to John, why couldn't one look for Zeeman effects in spectral lines doing this? And we started sort of thinking about line widths and things, and whether it was feasible.
Mm-hmm.
And John's contributions was really to say, what you want is an absorption line, because it's much narrower. And
the switching idea?
Right, and the switching, yes. And that was part of it. That was really Babcock type of thing. And the following day, I wrote that very short note and put it in ideas on paper. Never has it such a short article been responsible for wasting so much time by so many people.
Well, eventually not wasted.
No, not eventually, but it did seem at one stage as though people were spending years and years of PhD time not getting anywhere.
But once again, neither you nor Bolton tried this yourself.
No, I think what we were saying is that when more sophisticated instrumentation comes into play, as it were, or larger dishes and so on, and it was John Bank, I think, that
right.
Really, that time, put in the main effort. No, it was very much a passing thing, and it just arose out of a few days' visit.
Now I understand. It obviously looks strange amongst all these other papers here. Now, there's a paper here with Steve Smird in 57 and Phil Magg, where you talk about strip scan solar observations and how to interpret them.
That was written by Steve in my absence. And I tried very hard to get out of the authorship, but I think it was sort of... It was a... However, I did give a... I thought it was much too complicated the way he presented it all. But I did give a very simple version of it in another paper, which was probably some IAU meeting.
Jodrell Bank Symposium.
Jodrell Bank Symposium. That was a very simple version of it.
Mm-hmm.
Steve was working on this problem, and I just came up with an idea which helped simplify this high level problem.
Okay, let's go back to the States again, where you went to another AAS meeting and talked about the association. This is with Zarin. Eruptive prominences and 167 megahertz bursts.
Yes. Well, while I was at in the States, I spent about 3 months at high altitude, HAO, in their wooden huts at the time, and which is quite good. They had Sidney Chapman was there most of the time. Walter Roberts even was active. And Hal Zarin and I did a comparison. I was very much interested in the radio side of things, and Boulder had a very big collection of optical records, which they didn't do anything with, and also, of radio records, which they didn't do anything with, and also miles and miles of prominence film. So I suggested that we get together and look for correlations. And we wrote the paper which eventually appeared, this one.
In the Australian Journal of Physics, yeah.
And that must have been approved. I've forgotten all about it.
Right. But now, perhaps the interesting thing that came out of this, in my view, is that you found that it was when they got to the center of the disk that you got the noise storms. Was this the first indication of some directionality in the radio burst, or did you have some earlier?
I think there must have been indications of this from the early days. Even the very early paper by Rudy Payne Scott might have envisaged this. And even before that, even Hay might have.
I don't remember that, but that could well be.
Directivity of. Well, no, it probably wasn't Hay, because he didn't recognize the phenomenon of my storms. But I think it, the concept of directivity probably was earlier than that, but this was tying it up with the with in more detail.
Tell me about the rest of your stay in the U.S. In particular, which radio places you visited and what your assessment was of what they were doing.
Well, I can't remember all the places I went to, but the main places were Harvard for about 3 months, and then Boulder for about the same time, and then Michigan with Fred Haddock for about, also for about 3 months, and then moved west to spent some time again with Maxwell just before he went on the air at Fort Davis. And
in what role?
I suppose it's a rather saucy thing to say, but it was there I showed Helen our first U-burst, which was which we hadn't published. But
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear what you said.
A U-burst, right. Which is a Type 3, which goes
around. But what did you say about it?
Well, this was really the first Harvard discovery, which was the U-burst.
Right.
But we got one isolated example, but they got, we call it a number. And,
what was the ability that they had that... enable them to see them easier?
I'm not sure. I think it was probably just a matter of the pretty small sample activity that we'd recorded up to that time.
Was he connected with an 85-foot dish, or was that?
Well, he did have an 85-foot dish, yes. I don't know, but they're a very common phenomena. Mm-hmm. You know, they emerged as a very common
phenomenon. But now, were you more or less a technical advisor for the spectrograph? Or
it was Donald Menzel, really. Was it Menzel? No, maybe it was Leo Goldberg, Menzel and Goldberg between them. No, it was Donald Menzel, because I think Leo got me along to Michigan. Yes, I suppose at that time I was... I wanted to start up in this field, and I didn't see any, really any group done it before. So it was a very instructive time. I think I probably got a bit homesick, being away for too long.
What in the Harvard spectrograph? What were the main differences from your own?
Well, of course, one of the main differences is that they did it in the American style, which is the subcontract. I think it was to wear one instrument, right? Mm-hmm. And so everything was very professionally done, factory produced, and all this sort of thing. Where you, yes, the sort of method of budgeting is entirely different. Yes, but probably quite sensible when you consider salaries and everything. I don't think I made a very big contribution, as anything really more than could be got out of the papers. Only little bits here and there. I think, there may have been a few. Yes, there were a number of things where they were quite clearly doing the wrong thing, but they could have been cleared up in a couple of days, in actual fact. And so my own interest at Harvard was probably talking with all the astronomers and graduate students. It was quite an interesting time.
Such as Menzel?
Well, there were a whole lot of graduate students. Donald Menzel himself, I saw quite a bit of, because for a while I actually stayed with him in his house. So,
what was the question? Oh, did you learn anything in terms of equipment in your stay in the U.S., or was it mainly only some astrophysics that you were learning?
Well, I don't think I did very much, because I wasn't well, I was so remote from the technical scene, which was really in the airborne instrument labs. And certainly I could go around the labs, airborne instrument labs, but you don't learn very much, you see.
Right. When you visited Michigan or Caltech?
Well, I think that probably I counted some people that were... Is it Henry Jasek, the antenna king? I think and then there were a whole lot of people at Michigan involved in... was it then or later? In optical transforms and things like that, which interested me right here.
Once again, this is leading on to Kogura.
Yes, but on the whole, my main interest in instrumentation is in systems as a whole, I think. And I've never been, since Penrith, I've never done very much
nuts and bolts.
Electronic engineering with my own hands. But okay. I'm very interested in the optical systems.
Well, let's move on to the next major instrument you were involved with, which was the swept frequency interferometer, I believe. You operated the DAPTO station until the early 60s, I guess.
Yes.
But at what stage did you feel the need for something else?
It came up. It was stimulated by... Oh, you mean the sweat frequency interferometer? Yes. Yeah. Well, I think it was essential to keep things moving. We scooped the cream out of the pure spectrum by itself. There were some very important unanswered questions. The plasma hypothesis was a hypothesis and nothing more. It needed really confirmation. And a few quick sums showed that you could put together an interferometer without too much effort, which could answer a lot of these questions. In actual fact, it was quite a lot of effort, the interferometer.
What frame is it developed over?
That, I suppose, it started a... It really came down to earnest when I got back from the States.
56.
We had started a bit of this before with the scintillation work. We had some interferometric measurements for the signal scintillation work, but the whole thing had to be completely changed for the solar thing. One needed delay lines and all sorts of things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether you've had a look at the paper on the interferometer.
Not the paper itself, but the abstracts.
It was quite an extraordinary. Heath Robinson type device. While it was operating, there were tremendous noises going on all the time. Relays going in and out. And, moving parts, and then we had the facsimile recorder.
Mm-hmm. See, I guess Kevin Sheridan was working with you.
Yes, Kevin was well, this is the time. Kevin was more or less removed, possibly against his will, to work.
On this. What was he doing?
Well, he was with Bernie Mills, but Fawzi, actually, while I was away, just before I returned, Fawzi said that Tapton needs reinforcing technically, which it certainly did at that time, since John Merrick. And Kevin, very much against his will, was transferred, but...
Well, if I remember correctly now, Murray was taken off to go to the hydrogen line receiver because that needed reinforcement.
Right. And that left us with a void. We had Jim Roberts and myself, who were both physicists. I went away, and Max Komisarov, who was not at all a practical man, but very much a dreamer and a philosopher. So we had a very almost zero technical competence. Then Gil Trent, as a technical officer, added very solid support on the technical line, but not innovative engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And Kevin was a tremendous and I was saying it was against his will to begin with, but it took about 6 months, and then I think Kevin, you can ask him yourself, but I think he's being more pleased that it happened.
And that I got him into solar work. And
well, yes, and I think in a working environment, which he might probably be much better than his previous one.
Seems to me that I get the picture that Fawzi is sort of looking at all these small groups, that must have been five or six of them at least, sort of moving the pieces around.
Yes, I think that is a good example. I suppose that we picked on something which maybe we weren't aware of, but very much. But I suppose that's what happens within the CSIRO division. The way we work is to let things run and then every now and again review things and see how best to use your resources.
And you get reassigned and that's it?
Well, I think it was quite, Kevin's reassignment was quite a almost against his will. It's quite an unusual one. Usually you talk someone into it, right?
I guess that's the problem of management.
That's the management.
Okay, so now, with this interferometer, what were you able to establish? What were the main results that came from that? I see two papers here with Sheridan and Trent, and Sheridan and Nealon.
Right. When I came back from America, I found that to in a rather low state of rather low morale at the time, and I got working very hard on the interferometer, and there was some skepticism as to whether it could ever work. And
why was that?
All sorts of things, like would open wire transmission lines be a suitable way of linking two elements, or would there be too much leakage or too much attenuation or all this sort of thing. And it was also a very complicated, say, very Heath Robinson type of thing. There's lots of moving parts and all sorts of things that go wrong. I can remember Jim Roberts left us about that time.
Went to Caltech?
No, at that time I think he left Dapto, working at Dapto, rather to go and work up some of the solar results. And then he was going abroad, I think, to some IAU meeting. What was it?
Paris Symposium.
That's right. Yes.
Did you go to that meeting?
No, I didn't. I stayed behind to try and get some results to present it, really present at the symposium. And Jim left, I think it was about 5 weeks before. The Jabra Bank symposium, because he was going to Russia and I think it was Moscow meeting. We had, at the time he left, we had nothing to show whatsoever. We had no results out of the interferometer. During the next 5 weeks, we almost got the picture clear. It was the first 5 weeks of operation, and we were able to confirm the plasma hypothesis and get a number of interesting results about type 2s and type 4s. And that was quite a significant contribution, I think.
What was the key to this confirmation that you...
Let me see. Let me just switch it off for a
moment. What was this Wild Sheridan and Nealon paper you say was a key?
Well, the key diagram in that really was a coloured one, in which showed the about a dozen or more examples of limb flares. Once the position of the limb flare is shown, and the level at which the radio emission at four or five different frequencies, as measured by the interferometer, is shown in four or five different colors.
Mm-hmm.
And in every case, for types reversed, types reversed coming from those flares. And in every case, it was a regular sequence, the low frequency being on far out and the high frequency being close in. And it was quite a... It had to be very carefully interpreted, the results, because you had to make allowance for ionospheric refraction, which was quite tricky.
And different at the different frequencies. So,
right, yeah. And so one also had to study what happened during a continuum storm, and you could see the way different frequencies of time moved about. On some days it was an enormous swing, and obviously results were meaningless. On other days, it was very well behaved and results meant a lot, so you had to sort all those things out. But what emerged quite convincingly was the confirmation of the plasma hypothesis.
And these very high speeds.
Right, yep.
You said at first, referred to 55, that there was a lot of disbelief about these high speeds.
Right.
Had they been accepted by this time, or was this really
it was as a result of, I think this had to come first. Of course, one could still argue that it might be a particle. It might be a wave rather than a particle.
Mm-hmm.
The next step was really taken by one of my colleagues, quite a junior one at that time, Ron Stewart, and who did a systematic investigation of the not only the speeds but accelerations of type 3 bursts, and came to the conclusion that on the whole, speed tended to be constant throughout, so that the law one was dealing with was Newton's first law of motion. And a particle.
As opposed to an electromagnetic
phenomenon. Well, a plasma phenomenon, a plasma wave would never, you couldn't imagine a plasma wave remain constant velocity over an enormous range of
chronometry.
And I should say that out of this type 3 phenomenon, it's one of the most puzzling things in plasma physics. It's a problem of extreme interest now, I think, just in its own sake, how a bunch of particles manages to keep emitting plasma oscillations and plasma waves, manages to maintain its identity all the way.
Remain coherent.
Right, all the way from the lower solar atmosphere. And now we know right out to space because of the type 3 bursts have picked up satellites close to the Earth.
And that's still a puzzle, you're saying?
Yes, and a plasma theory, a very sophisticated puzzle, which doesn't bother most astrophysicists.
Only if you know enough on your path.
So that was perhaps the primary result that came from the swept frequency interferometer, would you say?
Yes.
How long did that instrument operate?
Not so very long. I think we did the right thing there. We got our results and then closed it down. And
when was this closing down?
Look, I can't remember whether it was 18 months or
something like that.
And, then we operated. Then we got increasingly, well, what it led to was the radioheliograph. I suppose I started thinking about the radioheliograph while I was still in the States. It was the obvious next step to try and get radio pictures.
And so, in fact, from 59 or 60 until the radio heliograph went to operation, which was 67?
Between about 1960 and 1967, my attention was almost entirely
towards that.
Devoted to a little bit of dabbling in interesting records that came along, but mostly thinking about the heliograph.
So can you just outline for me what the sequence of critical events in the design and construction of the radio heliograph were? I guess going right back to the States visit.
Well, I suppose the this